welcome to the Well and Well podcast. I'm your host, Susie Clark, and I am a corporate dropout turned coach and mentor for aspiring entrepreneurs. This podcast is all about sharing stories from inspirational guests who basically chose the unconventional route in life and achieved success on their own terms. So a lot of my guests tended to start out in what society would call a conventional route, so say perhaps a corporate job, or they went to uni and got a degree, but at some point they really realised that what they were doing just wasn't for them, and they decided to take a risk, start their own business, and completely change direction and achieve their own version of success. And by sharing their stories, I just want to show you that success is possible for any passion that you have. And if you have a different dream to the one that you're living now, that's absolutely okay. And it's just never too late to change direction. So episode 22 then, I am bringing you this intro from Bali in Indonesia. I finally moved. I landed on Wednesday last week, so a couple of days ago, and it's amazing. I'm loving the heat, I'm loving the sun, I'm loving the tropical vibes and everything about it. And I can't wait to share more updates with you on Bali life. So if you're interested, head over to my Instagram. It's SusieClark_, so SusieClark_, and follow me there, and I'll be posting all sorts of updates about Bali life and the entrepreneur vibe out here and all the digital nomad scene and everything all exciting like that. But this week I have a really inspiring guest on. She is an entrepreneur in the wellness industry. Her name is Jess Leonard Hull, and she is the founder of a social enterprise called Loom. So Jess started out in a corporate job, actually in sales, within the medical industry, and she did enjoy it. She talks a lot about it, but she kind of realized that there was something, it wasn't her passion, it wasn't her true kind of calling in life. And she went through a series of courses to upskill herself and kind of dip into a few different things, like training as a yoga teacher. She also did a mindfulness teacher training as well. And she figured out that actually that was her passion. The wellness industry was her passion. She got an opportunity to work with Streatham Council to deliver mindfulness programs into schools within Streatham, which sounds like it was an incredible kind of initiative, but sadly the funding got cut. So at that point, Jess decided to take matters into her own hands and create her own social enterprise called Loom. So it's really interesting to hear her story and all about the decisions that she made, and a lot about the upskilling. I think that's such good advice for any of you out there who know that what you're doing isn't what you want to do, but you don't necessarily know what you do want to do. Just trying a few little things, dipping your toes into different courses, and Jess talks all about that. She also talks a lot about mindfulness and the science behind it and why it's so important in today's high stress environment, which is really interesting because I think sometimes that's the thing that's missing with all these buzzwords at the moment, like mindfulness and wellness and stuff. We don't tend to hear much about the scientific studies backing it up, but they are out there, and I think it's a shame because that would get a lot of more people's buy-in to actually practice some of these techniques, which are so beneficial for all of us. So I'm going to stop talking now, but I hope that you enjoy this episode, and thank you so much for listening, and just make sure you hit subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. Hey, welcome, Jess. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
Hi.
How's your week going so far?
Yeah, it's been nice. I mean, it's Tuesday, so
yep.
But so far so good.
Yeah, good. So. But I'm really excited to speak to you today, and I think your story is very similar to mine as well, so it's really nice to chat to someone who kind of gets it. So first of all, I wanted to talk a little bit about how you started out your career in sales. Mm-hmm. So how you kind of ended up there, from like, did you go to uni, or like how did you start out in sales?
So it's not a very straightforward story. At uni I did Spanish and English literature, mm-hmm. and I moved to Barcelona straight when I graduated, and I was working in marketing and yeah, online marketing stuff there. Mm-hmm. And it was, there was some sales stuff in, like bringing, you know, trying to get accounts in, but I wasn't really at that level. And then I was in Barcelona for like 2.5 years.
Nice.
And then I went to go and work in India.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I actually went to go and work for like a king in India.
What? This is the best thing ever.
I told you it was a bit of a roundabout story. So this was in Udaipur, and he's the Maharana of Udaipur.
Right.
And I was working with UNESCO,
okay.
The UN's cultural branch, because all of his palaces are UNESCO World Heritage
okay.
sites.
Wow.
And they were doing a UNESCO World Heritage Festival, and I was helping to kind of project manage that.
Cool. How long were you doing that for?
It was 6 months.
What an opener.
I know. yeah, so from Barcelona to Udaipur in India, okay. working for a king, like a legit king, and
yep.
like a palace, and like
amazing.
Udaipur is amazing. If you've ever been, anyone's ever been there, it's on the lake. It's called the Lake City. There are palaces in the center
wow.
of the lake that look like they're floating on the water. And
oh my God,
yeah. So I did that, and then I actually, you know, as always happens in India, eventually. I got really sick and yeah, stomach like dysentery.
Yeah.
Which is like some medieval level stuff.
Oh God.
Yeah, and it just went on and on and on, and I was just like, I just want mashed potatoes. That's yeah. all I wanted was mashed potatoes and peas and like yeah.
No more curry,
no more spicy food, which was amazing, but when you're sick, that's like not what you want to
yeah.
be eating. So I came back really, really suddenly to the UK, and I really didn't know where I was going to be living. I was living at home, but I really had no plan for when I came back. Mm-hmm. Like literally, it was like I came back about a month earlier or 6 weeks earlier than I was supposed to, and I was really, really sick, really couldn't eat
oh God,
a lot of
okay.
stuff. And yeah, was broke basically yeah. also. and yeah, I hadn't lived in the UK for like 3.5 years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that summer was actually like the hardest summer of my life, really, because mm-hmm. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And whilst I was in India, I'd done meditation training and my yoga teacher training,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to do it full time.
Yeah.
So I was looking for jobs here in the UK. And I think also with the yoga stuff, I just didn't know how to get started.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and I was just applying for jobs. I was like 25,
okay.
but I was going for like graduate job
yeah.
scheme things and not getting anywhere, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, it was really demoralizing.
Tough.
Like
yeah,
I remember I was on a bus coming back from an interview. It was a data storage like management company or
yeah.
something, and they'd given me a test on data.
Oh God.
On like, and it was literally like, how much data could you buy with £60? And I had no idea. Like literally like
yeah.
no idea. And they were like, Jessica, so why do you want to work in data storage management?
What a question.
And I was like, I was like, I don't. I just
yeah.
want a job.
How do you blag that one?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, you know, like talking about, I was like, the cloud. That's like the only word I knew. Anyway, so just going through that, and then I got a job with a medical sales company.
Okay,
so
nice.
So it's just, yeah, and it really appealed to me, like the flexibility of
mm-hmm.
it. I was a field rep, so driving around, my patch was the southeast of England.
Mm-hmm.
So could have been like, you know, East Anglia,
mm-hmm.
Norfolk, or it could have been in Brighton.
Lovely.
Or London, or yeah.
Nice.
So yeah, that's how I ended up in sales.
And I just want to ask you also how your time was in Barcelona, what it was like living there.
Barcelona was amazing. Anyone who's been to Barcelona knows it's a great city. There were two things that kind of prompted me to look at other opportunities. Mm-hmm. One was that the nationalist, the Catalan independence yeah. movement was really, really gaining traction. I was interviewing for jobs, and I speak Spanish and French and Italian.
Nice.
And they would be like, oh, well, do you speak Catalan?
Right.
And there was just very much a sentiment that, like, unless you're Catalan,
yeah,
you know, you're not necessarily welcome here, quite mm-hmm. frankly. I think there's a very, it was like a precursor to things that were also going on here with Brexit and stuff
right,
like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was like the first thing. And then also, I think if you grow up, you know, both my parents are entrepreneurs and have had their own businesses and stuff. And the working culture in Spain is different. Mm. And the opportunities just aren't the same as they are here in London. So I was really craving that kind of dynamism, the speed of things, the opportunities, the kind of entrepreneurial kind of, yeah, well, if we don't know how to do it, we'll figure it out, we'll create a solution.
Yeah.
Which, during my time in Barcelona, I didn't really find.
Mm-hmm. Okay, makes sense. Okay, so let's chat a little bit then about your experience in sales. So just to add some context, so medical sales, what does that mean? What were you kind of selling?
I was selling something called the SurgiLig, which is an orthopedic device for soft tissue reconstruction.
Right.
So if people tear a ligament and they have to have their ligament repaired, it's like a graft, it's a trellis.
Mm-hmm.
If you imagine that you have a trellis that plants grow up, it's a trellis that you attach to the bones, and then your previous ligaments, your ligament can then use that as a structure to grow over. So I actually loved the job. I loved going into hospitals. Mm. I loved talking with surgeons. Like, it was it's a really good product.
So you were selling into hospitals?
Yeah, so you literally you go into operations.
Wow.
It's wild. So I was like going, you have to do a lot of training, a lot of technical training, but you go into operations with surgeons and you advise the surgeons how to use the product.
In the middle of the operation? Yeah. I didn't even consider that. Yeah,
so you're like in scrubs. You're all scrubbed up.
God, I bet you've seen some things.
Yeah. I loved it though. Like, I absolutely loved it. And like, obviously working within the NHS was amazing. Doctors are amazing. Nurses are amazing.
Yeah.
Like, you're working with the whole thing. So yeah, it was really cool. You know, you'd go in and speaking to like really intelligent, hardworking people who are looking for the best product to help improve people's lives, like, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting that you did have that element of I've spoken about this with previous guests who have been in sales as well, and not having that like connection with the product in terms of how it's impacting that person.
Yeah.
But you kind of did have that, I suppose, in that job.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And we, like, you know, a lot of people who use these products with sportsmen or women. Mm. So there are a lot of like professional rugby players or skiers or cyclists, because usually it comes from people falling off bikes or in rugby accidents or skiing accidents that, you know, tear ligaments or whatever. And so we have a lot of like professional, like England and Wales rugby players who would come out at events and be like, oh yeah, my SurgiLig is working really well. You're like, let me feel your bicep.
That's so funny. I love that. Okay, so that's really good context. And in terms of your experience there, like objectively, I suppose, what did you
Like, I guess there was a couple of things that you liked there, but what were the things that you didn't necessarily like, or it wasn't kind of fulfilling you in?
Yeah, I think being a field rep is quite a lonely job. It's great for the flexibility of it, and that, you know, you get to create your own diary and all this stuff, but you're like out by yourself, basically. And a lot of people who do that usually have families. It's like, it's great for like people with kids, and because they can have that flexibility. So it was the lack of kind of a team that I really, really missed. And then also the driving, like I could be driving for like 8 hours a day, sometimes eight, nine. And operation lists in the NHS are quite fluid. So you'd be called up to go to an operation, and it could be like an 8 a.m. operation, and you could be waiting there for 6 hours.
Of course.
And then sometimes they just get cancelled. And that actually, so when I decided that I couldn't do it anymore, I'd gone for a 9 a.m. operation in Merthyr Tydfil.
Where's
in
that?
Wales.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like a four and
South
a half.
Southeast territory?
No, I was covering for a friend, and they were like, oh, please, can you go to this operation, Merthyr Tydfil? And it was a 5 hour drive. So I left London. I left London at like 4:30 a.m. And I get there and I walk up and I'm like, oh, hi, I'm here for the operation with, you know, Dr. So and so. And they're like, oh, did he not tell you? I got cancelled?
Oh, no.
I was like, sorry, I thought somebody had called you. I was like, are you kidding?
Oh, no. Classic.
Yeah, and I was just like, do you know what? I just don't want to be doing it like this.
Just smile and turn away.
I was like, ah. Like, and drive another 5 hours back to London.
Oh my God, what a waste of time.
Yeah, and I was just like, yes, you're getting paid for that, but like,
yeah,
I would have been driving for like 10 hours and done nothing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was the driving, and then, yeah. That.
And how did you start to sort of feel at that point? Were you getting really sort of down with yourself? Because I know with me, when I realised that there were a lot of things I didn't really like about, like, corporate life, I suppose, it started to really grate on me.
Yeah, so when I was spending so much time in the car, I really listened to a lot of audiobooks and podcasts, and a lot around like entrepreneurial things. So Tim Ferriss and stuff like that, and I just was hearing all these amazing things and just felt really trapped, basically. Like I couldn't like almost like a creativity thing. I just couldn't create what I wanted to create in the world. And also I started teaching some yoga on the side, just like in the evenings and stuff. And as I kept trying to find cover, basically, for those classes. And it became really clear to me that I was enjoying teaching those classes more than I was my job. And it was like really like effect when I had to find cover, which was kind of more, I just felt, I hated it. Like I was like, oh, I want to be there. Like, that's what I want to be doing.
Yeah.
So it just got to a point I was like, you know, you've got to make a decision and a choice.
I think it's so interesting because a lot of people who have ended up having businesses, their experience when they started in corporate, their experience has often started with consuming content of like podcasts or books or something that's broadened their mind, if you know what I mean. Whereas if I think about my mindset when I first started out in corporate, it's much more narrow to what was possible or what I should be doing, whereas now there's so many options that I see as equal. So it's really interesting that yours kind of started out with that as well.
And I think also with Tim Ferriss and people like in particular, like, they're such advocates kind of flexible working and using different technologies. And, you know, starting your own business isn't like what it used to be. Even working now, like, you can do everything remotely. You can, there's so much more flexibility now. And I think that also really appealed to me.
Yeah, it's good to kind of challenge convention, I suppose. Okay, and jumping back a bit, actually, but you said you did your yoga teacher training in India. Mm-hmm. How was that?
It was amazing. So I actually had six or eight weeks in between my job in Spain finishing and my job in India starting. So I went out early and I went and stayed at an Ayurvedic center.
We should explain what that means to the listeners.
So Ayurveda is like traditional Indian medicine. Like you get traditional Chinese medicine with acupuncture and different herbs and things like that. Ayurveda is the same but in the Indian context, and it has a lot to do with yoga as well, and it treats people really holistically. It's a lifestyle medicine. So it also looks at the state of your mind and what you're eating, your exercise and your meditation and things like that. And no one's ever ill in Ayurveda. There's just things that are out of balance, which is something that really, really resonated with me. Instead of being like, oh, you know, you have this, this is wrong with you, it's like, okay, this is a symptom of something else that's out of balance. How can we correct that,
like,
balance?
Cause and effect.
Exactly. So yeah, it's a really, just a really beautiful way of living, really. It's kind of really taking care of your whole self. And I had polycystic ovaries and stuff, and you know, my doctor here in the UK just prescribed me to go on the pill to just regulate my periods. And it just, I was like 18 when I was diagnosed. And even then I remember thinking like, so this is like a hormonal disorder and you're prescribing me more hormones just to regulate my periods. Like, anyway, so that actually is like what triggered me investigating other kind of lifestyle medicines and discovering yoga and meditation and stuff like that.
Amazing.
But yeah, so I did my yoga teacher training in India and it was amazing. It was in Mysore and it was with three Indian guys, which was really important for me to do it with Indians. They have been studying yoga since they were 13. Mm. They were at like a, I guess like a religious school, but a yoga school. And there were Indians on the course as well, and I just thought that that was really important to me to kind of preserve the heritage of that practice.
Interesting. No, that sounds amazing. Sounds like quite a hardcore teacher training as well.
Yes and no. I mean, there was a lot more kind of spirituality and like kirtan singing, which is like yogic singing choir chanting and stuff. So it was not, it was really, really nice.
Amazing.
Great.
So then I guess, so you started teaching straight away when you came back on the side of your job?
Just
gradually picked it
just
up.
Just gradually. I just kind of, again, I was living at my mum's house in Bicester.
Lovely.
And I was like, I knew I wanted to kind of teach. And interestingly, I'd gone into my yoga teacher training being like, I don't want to teach. Like, I'm just doing this just to like understand more about yoga. I was very adamant about that. And then as I started teaching, it, something about it just felt really right. Like, I'd never had like a talent in inverted commas, or at school, like there was nothing that, I was very like good at everything, like average, but I never really excelled at anything. And I remember when it, in our yoga teacher training, it came up to teaching bits and I was just like, oh my, I just feel very like natural at this.
That's really nice that you found that though. It would be good to just talk about this as well, if there are any of the listeners out there that want to, it could be yoga, but it could be like personal training, it could be anything, start that on the side of their job. Do you have any advice for that? And in terms of, I guess, getting your confidence up ready to go and teach your first class on the side of having a job as well.
I wouldn't wait for your confidence to get up. You've just got to go. Like, you've just got, I remember calling up, and I just called up gyms, local gyms and stuff, and I remember the feeling in my chest, like, oh, like I can feel it now, like just so anxious, so scared. And you just call them up. But I think also you've got to remember, like, if you go back to the why you're doing it, like, because you want to help people feel better. And I really felt this responsibility that I have learned the tools of how to make people feel more at peace with themselves and relaxed and calm, and it's just about passing that on.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and I think that was similar to my experience when I did my teacher training. I came back and then that someone had told me there's a like London cover Facebook group, so I just went on there, managed to get a cover in a Pure gym the next week, turned up, and I was so scared. I was like terrified, but turned up, 15 people showed up, there's no blocks, no nothing, bright awful light, and I just had to force myself, and just I said to myself, well, no class is ever going to be as bad as the first one, so you've just got to get that out the way.
And also people have no idea, like, I so often that you think in your head, like, oh my god, like, I did that really badly, or I missed that bit of the sequence, or I didn't say that, or that didn't make sense. People have no idea.
No. And what I always just say, if you ever get stuck, just put them in a forward fold.
Also,
there's like composure stuff. No one's looking at you.
If you give them a good savasana at the end, like, they'll forgive anything.
Like, my teacher, my yoga teacher, training teacher, told us that, like, most people will remember, like, the last 7 minutes of your class. You really, really need to make that great. But yeah, but I think that's similar advice to what I'd say in terms of people, if they want to start something on the side, you've just got to go for it, and just know that the first few times you do something, it's going to be shit. But like, you've got to start somewhere to get better at it.
And I kind of felt very like almost like reckless, like, oh my god, I don't know what I'm doing, but then so so quickly you start to feel at home in it and comfortable with it
and finding your style.
Nice.
Okay, so let's take it back to the job then, and at what point did you decide that you didn't want to do sales anymore and make that like change? And I also want to talk at this point about that manager that you had that was so supportive, because I think that's incredible.
I was really well, so I, because of my languages, I kind of was getting asked to do more export sales stuff and go visit distributors in Spain and elsewhere in Europe, and again it kept meaning that I had to miss like find cover for my classes, and it was kind of getting to a point where the gyms I was working for were like, listen, like, can you really do this? And I remember I'd been asked to go on a business trip to Greece. I just didn't want to go. I was like, I just don't want to go. Like, and I said to my manager, I was like, listen, like, I really, and the export stuff had just kind of happened gradually. It was like, oh, could you do that? And it wasn't like a formal discussion. And I remember sitting down with her. It was in a prep, because we were having like catch up, prep by Baker Street. And I was like, listen, like, and she was like, what do you want to be doing? And I was like, terrified. I was like, she's like, listen, if you don't want to be doing this, then tell me and I can help you find, you know, that's something amazing. Else and tell me what you really want to be doing. And I kind of blurted out, and she was like, okay, like, and she was,
well, what is it that you said to her?
So, so this is still my thing, is that I want to have retreat centers. Like, my end goal is to have retreat centers, to have these kind of spaces in nature where people can come and reconnect with themselves and do personal work and all this stuff. And she was like, that's amazing, people need that. Aww. And so she was like, let me have a think. She's like, I know this person that works in wellness, I know this, and she started just introducing me to these different people, and a friend of hers ran a retreat center in France, and
that's so amazing. That just shows how much of like a great leader she is, and she kind of wanted to mentor you in a way outside of the scope of like her role, I suppose, of being a manager of yours. I think that's a really amazing thing to hear.
She did a lot of, do you know Simon Sinek? So she was a big advocate of his kind of management style and read a lot of his books, and
nice. So you had her support, and she was putting you in touch with different people, and this was becoming like more realistic as something to go and do. So at what point did you then take the leap and quit your job?
So it was that kind of time, and I was just like, okay, And I was like, I want to be in London. Because at this point, I was living at home. I didn't want to be in Bicester, but I didn't see how to, like... So I was just like, okay, like... So I quit my job and I moved to London. Well, no, I got some more teaching in London. And then I got a part-time job at Lululemon. Lululemon's flagship store on Regent Street, which was amazing.
And you, because we were chatting about this before, and you said that you took that like for the networking as well, and obviously like financially it's useful, but what was the experience like there?
It was amazing. I was kind of looking for jobs in wellness, like it could be in a gym or any other clothing brand, and Lululemon, kind of that opportunity came up, and it was amazing. I went on as like a seasonal Christmas hire and then stayed on, and it was to meet people within the industry but also like-minded people who were, you know, passionate about wellness and things. Lululemon is a really special company to work for. Like, I actually had the best time working there. They really look after their employees. You get loads of work perks. And they just employ really, really great people from all over the world. So even now, so I left Lulu nearly 2 years ago. But even now, you know, some of my closest friends in London are, you know, from Canada or New Zealand or the Netherlands. And and also just meeting people in the London wellness scene.
Nice. I actually have a friend who's recently just joined their head office, and part of her interview process was a spin class.
I thought that was so
cool. She had a choice between like bar and spin or something.
Yeah,
so like, that sounds like a great interview.
Yeah.
Although then I think she got like questioned afterwards and then she's just super sweaty.
Team sweats is called, so everyone will go and like work out together. You also get a prepaid Visa credit card with like an assigned amount to spend on exercise classes every month.
Oh, love that.
Yeah.
Well, that sounded like a good decision. So at that point then you had Lululemon, you were teaching in the yoga studios as well. What were you doing in terms of trying to bring this idea to life?
So my business idea wasn't even formed yet.
Right, okay.
So that wasn't, that didn't come out until a year ago. So I was just, I'd done a mindfulness for children and yoga for children teacher training course, as well as my mindfulness teacher training course. And I was doing a lot of work in schools, covering for people randomly, and I actually got picked up by a council-run scheme in Streatham to bring mindfulness to a school as a pilot scheme to kids there as part of their, as part of a bigger mental health initiative. And in Streatham, there are quite a few socioeconomic issues that kids there are facing. So yeah, mindfulness was brought in as a kind of mental health support.
That's amazing that that was a government scheme. What year was this? Yeah,
so these, this was years, what age
groups? What year did they have that? When did they bring that scheme out? Because I'm surprised. Like, it feels like the government stuff is so far behind. Surprised that they...
So it was council, so I don't know how it worked between the council initiating things and the government. I don't really know how that works. It was a, it was, it was Streatham Council, I think it might be Lambeth.
It's amazing.
Council. That was, it would mean September, what are we, September 29th? I'm trying to figure out the academic year. So not last year, but the year before.
Okay. Nice. So maybe I think like that's really great to hear that they were doing an initiative like that.
Yeah.
Also, I just want to pause on this as well and ask you a little bit about mindfulness teacher training. What's involved in there? Because, I mean, I kind of understand, like, from the yoga background, and I do a lot of these practices, but some of the listeners might not quite understand what comes under the umbrella of mindfulness. And if you're going to do a teacher training, what are the things you're actually learning?
Definitely, this is something I love talking about. So just to clarify, mindfulness is a meditation technique. So meditation is like physical exercise. You have as many different types of meditation as there are physical exercise, and they mm-hmm. all have different outcomes, just as different physical exercises have different kind of outcomes and objectives. Mm-hmm. And mindfulness is one branch of meditative practices, just as weightlifting is a branch of meditation physical exercise practices. And you can get meditations for visualization, for self-compassion, for you get mantra-based ones. There are lots of different ones. Mindfulness meditation is concentration and awareness training. Mm. So it's sets of mental exercises for your brain to improve your concentration and awareness.
Okay.
And it's scientifically proven. It's also secular, so there are no religious affiliations, as you know, meditation features in majority of religions. There are meditative practices in Christianity, there were in Hinduism and Buddhism. I think it's important to acknowledge that mindfulness definitely has its roots in Buddhist practices, and that it's been going on there for thousands of years. But these are practices that have been brought over by mainly by a guy called Jon Kabat-Zinn, who works at University of Massachusetts Hospital, University Hospital. And they took these practices and applied scientific research to them.
Interesting. I love hearing about the science of it. There's a book called The Science of Yoga, and honestly, it transformed like everything. Yeah. When you've got that evidence backing it up, it's incredible.
Yeah. So this was back in the 70s and 80s, and then recently what's happened is, because of advances in neuroimaging technology, it's called fMRI scanning, they can put neuroimaging technology on the brains of Buddhist monks and actually see the neurological changes that take place with a meditation practice. Mm. And it's incredible.
Oh, I'd love to learn more about that.
Oh, I can give you that. This is what I like geek out on. This is actually what originally drew me to mindfulness. So I come from a family with quite a long history of addiction and mental health issues. And I'd kind of recognized some of these tendencies in myself. Mm. And then I was kind of looking at mindfulness and meditation as a way of helping to build my mental resilience against those, which they literally do. It's literally like going to the gym for your brain. So you strengthen parts of your brain responsible for impulse control, responsible for kind of addictive behaviors, and you literally make your brain more resilient against stress. That is I don't want to go down like this rabbit hole.
That's so interesting, and it's so topical at the moment, because I feel that is the little extra bit that we need in society, because I feel a lot of people are hearing mindfulness, meditation, they know it's something they should do, but a lot of people who aren't necessarily like interested in it for themselves, they're just like, oh, I need to do this. It's that knowing the scientific like evidence behind it, which then says to them, this actually physically does something to me, it does actually cause it. It's not just a sort of spiritual thing with nothing behind it. I don't feel like that is enough awareness is like created on that side of it, if that makes sense.
And I think, you know, we live in a science-based society, an evidence-based society, so that can just give people that reassurance they need to get going with a mindfulness practice. So it's even after doing 8 minutes a day for 2 weeks, you start to see these things. So it just can tide you over, and then you start to notice the changes in yourself. But it's just as with a physical exercise practice, like after one, going for a run once, you don't see the change, but it takes time. You start noticing, oh God, I didn't get so tired when I ran up the stairs. Like, it's a similar thing with mindfulness practices, that you, maybe something stressful happens and you just notice that, oh, I didn't react how I usually react to that. Like, I didn't lose my temper, or I didn't, like, you know, do whatever I usually do in a stressful situation. And it's these little things that you start to notice that make a big difference. And just on that, around the training, and this is something that's quite a kind of controversial, not controversial, but it's a well-debated topic in mindfulness. Obviously, mindfulness originated in spiritual and religious practices. Mm-hmm. And now there's mindfulness teacher training programs. And it's kind of, how can you teach people, can you really teach people to be mindfulness teachers? And is it just a money-making thing? And if it's, there's just a lot of complexity around it. And obviously a lot of these mindfulness teacher training courses are very, very new. Mm. And you've got teachers, amazing meditation teachers, who have been around for decades, who have a depth of knowledge and wisdom and experience and all this stuff. And then it's like, oh, but have you got a certificate?
Mm.
And I get that. I totally get that. But I also think that these are now being used as a mental health service and support. And if people aren't qualified to deal, because stuff does come up. Like when we start to sit and listen to our thoughts and notice what's going on inside us, instead of being distracted all the time, stuff comes up. And unless you're trained properly to deal with that and help someone through that, I can think it's dangerous. Mm. And there are a lot of people that will go off and do these meditation retreats and all this stuff comes up, and the people teaching them aren't trained or equipped to deal with that. And I'm a huge advocate for proper mindfulness teacher training, because I just think it needs to be done. Yes, it's kind of annoying maybe for some people, and that I can understand the argument is that it's a religious practice or it's a spiritual practice.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
But okay, but don't do it in a mental health context then.
Yeah, when you link it to that, that's when it can be risky.
And the NHS now prescribes mindfulness courses and stuff like that. So these are people with, you know, like severe anxiety or depression or whatever. You can now get masters in mindfulness from Oxford University and Bangor University.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Oxford Centre of Mindfulness is doing amazing stuff around this. The research they're doing into it is incredible. So you can get a master's with them and Bangor University. And then you can also do what's called the teacher training pathway, which is what I did with an organisation called Mindfulness UK. And you teach and learn at the same time.
Mm.
So you have you have your course that you do, and then you can go out and teach, and then you have a supervisor, and you have to record some of your sessions, and then you send those back. And that is the core, those two courses. You can do the academic one, the master's, or you can do the teacher training pathway. But you've got to make sure that, and I would say anyone that's looking for a mindfulness teacher, you go onto the UK network of registered mindfulness practitioners. Okay. That's how you guarantee that you're getting someone who's properly trained and equipped to deal with it properly.
And we're so going on a tangent here, but it's so fascinating. So if somebody was going to hire a mindfulness teacher, what kind of reasons would they do that? Would it be someone that has anxiety, that wants to know how to manage it? I know there are reasons, but what's the normal kind of
challenge? Usually it's to do with anxiety, depression, insomnia. Meditation and mindfulness is the most effective way to improve your sleep, like the quality of your sleep and the quantity of your sleep. And people who are feeling empty inside. I think that we are very lucky to be living in an age where a lot of our basic needs are met. We live, in lives where, we've been to university and all these things, and we live quite comfortable lives. And I think, we've kind of come to this point where it's like, we've got the job, we've got the salary, and you know this as well as I do.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh crap, like, I still feel empty.
Yeah.
And I think,
such a good word. I've never used that word for it, but that is exactly it.
Yeah, it's this thing of like, and you just have this realization, maybe you've had like, got one bonus or one pay rise, another pay rise, and you're like, I still feel the same. Why am I not feeling like better? Numb. Why am I feeling so empty? And I think that's the point when people either start running away from it and doing drugs and partying and whatever to numb that out, or people are like, what else is there? And I think that's when people start to be like, you know, and they just notice that they just can't sit with themselves.
So in a session with a client, what kind of things would you be doing?
So it depends. So I do one-on-one coaching as well. We also do, there is a course, it's called the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction course, which is the clinical course that's the gold standard for mindfulness training. So it depends why, if they're coming through the course and there's that set course and you talk about what stress is, because stress is the most taxing thing on our bodies and minds, the adrenaline, the cortisol, the lack of sleep, the lack of proper rest, and a lot of anxiety and things comes from stress.
So
that's what we start to look at. We look at what stress is, how people are experiencing stress, and then we start to do the mindfulness practices. And what mindfulness actually does is it trains your relaxation response. So if you, we have two branches of our nervous system.
This is really good because I want to, it's fascinating for me, and also it's good to educate like the listeners as well.
So you have two branches of your nervous system. You have what's called your parasympathetic nervous system and then your sympathetic nervous system. And your sympathetic nervous system is your fight or flight response. And then your parasympathetic nervous system is your, what's called your rest and digest. And as humans, we are supposed to spend, we're designed to spend all of our time in our parasympathetic nervous system. Like if you look at hunter-gatherers and things like that, they spend maybe 2 or 3 hours a day hunting, gathering food. The rest of the time they spend lying around, chatting, you know, doing each other's hair, cooking, just like literally do. And that if you go to a lot of kind of agricultural villages still in developing countries, that's still very much the quality of life that people have. In our modern day society, that is not the case. We live like chronically stressed lives. We're exhausted, we're not sleeping properly, we're drinking a lot of caffeine and you know, alcohol and maybe other recreational drugs which are throwing us out of whack. And then we're stressed and we've got a lot of adrenaline and cortisol, so we're constantly in our sympathetic nervous system. So if you think adrenaline is the opposite to being able to sleep, and also when you're in your sympathetic nervous system, you can't digest properly, your digestive system shuts down, so a lot of IBS is actually to do with stress.
Interesting. Okay,
yeah, I mean there's like a whole other thing about the gut and the brain and that type of thing. And so if you think our brain is made of fat and water. And if you think every time we do a behavior or a thought, it kind of creates what's called a neuron pathway, like tracks through snow in our brain. And the more you go over that track, the better entrenched it becomes. So the more times we get stressed, the quicker we become stressed, and the easier it is for us to slip into our sympathetic nervous system. So adrenaline, cortisol and stuff is being released. In mindfulness, what we're doing is rehearsing our relaxation response. So we're rehearsing our ability to relax, we're rehearsing our ability for our heart rate to slow down, our breathing rate to slow down, our digestion to system to release and relax. We're rehearsing our ability to not produce adrenaline and cortisol. And that's what you're, that's the biggest benefit. In essence, that's what we're doing when we practice the mindfulness practice.
That's fascinating. That's so interesting, basically training that element of it in the same way that you physically train in the gym, kind of thing.
Exactly, and that is, it means that when a stressful situation comes up, instead of slipping into your fight or flight mode, which is literally that, you either get angry or you retreat and you like people freeze. It's often called fight, flight, or freeze. You either people kind of freeze and paralyze, or they fight and they get angry, they lose their temper, or they're like, get me out of here, like abort mission, get me out. That's the running away thing. So we only have, when we're stressed, there are only three options. There's, our brain can only do those three things, one of those three things. And that's when people start to notice, well, after doing a mindfulness practice consistently, a stressful situation will come up, like don't know, they just missed their bus, or the train is delayed, or their boss gives them like some strong worded feedback, and they notice that usually they'll be like, they'll either run to the toilets and cry, or they'll lose their temper, or they'll just paralyze. And then in that situation, which is a just a stimulus for a stressed response, they just notice that they just are more relaxed and they choose a different way of reacting.
Mm. That's so interesting. I feel like we could do a whole another podcast on this. Maybe we should.
Yeah.
But let's take it back to then this government scheme in Chatham.
Rewind.
Yeah. So this government scheme in Streatham, you got involved with that to bring mindfulness to schools.
Yeah.
Let's chat a little bit about like what you did with that, because I think it's a great initiative, and I know it didn't necessarily continue, but it would be good to just talk about
the effects that it had. I was doing a 6-week mindfulness for children course with years 3 to 6. I would go in, do an hour a week with each, or a 45-minute class with each class group. These are kids who are largely from like immigrant populations, living in council funded accommodation, and there's a lot of socioeconomic stuff going on. So a lot of violence, a lot of kind of gang stuff going on. In our second class, I was in with year 3, so that's 7-year-olds, and this little kid, we were talking about what causes kids stress, and usually with kids it's like them being told stuff they don't want to do things like that's stressful for them, siblings taking their stuff, that stresses them out, and then people they love getting sick and not being able to, and we're talking about, you know, people like, you know, oh yeah, my grandpa got cancer and I felt really sad, or yeah, my mum had to go to hospital, like, you know, kind of talking about that. I'm like, yeah, that's really difficult. And then this one kid puts his hand up and he was like, oh yeah, my brother got stabbed last week.
Oh my god,
he came home, my mum was out at the shops and I didn't know what to do, and he wouldn't let me call the police, and I tried to make him a cup of tea, and that's when I was
oh my god, how did you
and I was just like, I was, and the teacher's obviously aware this
tried
is
to make
happened.
Him a cup of tea.
I know.
Oh, that would have got me. So
I know. And I was just like, I just looked, and I was like, that sounds like it was really, really, really stressful for you. And he was like, yeah, it was. It was. I just didn't know what to do. I was seven years old. Yeah.
Kills me.
So you know, that's what, not all of these kids, but some of them. That's like where they're growing up.
Yeah.
That's like their reality. And it's just about equipping them with the tools to now. Obviously, there also has to be like societal changes, funding changes, kind of infrastructural changes. But this is just, whilst these kids are in the midst of that, it's about equipping them with the tools to navigate that and look after their mental well-being.
And were they quite receptive to some of these practices? Because it could, they may not have ever been exposed to these things before. So it'd be really interesting. But equally, they're kids, they haven't really got any prejudgment of it either. So
so the younger kids, well, they all love it. I kind of bribe them in the first class.
Really?
We do mindful eating with minstrels.
Oh. And I wish I could do mindful eating with minstrels.
And that literally, that like gets them in. So that gets buy-in from them initially. It can be really hard for them. Kids, like our attention spans for kids have gone down by kind of 150% in the past 5 years.
Wow.
So getting them to a point where they can just sit still for 2 minutes is a challenge. But they love it. They absolutely love it on the whole. Kids really want to be still and calm and notice things.
Especially in some of those households where it would have been like so much going on. Okay, that's amazing. And then, so how, I know that the scheme didn't continue, unfortunately.
So we did two. I did one in Tower Hamlets as well, with Tower Hamlets Council, and then another area with some kind of complex stuff going on. And then it was a 6-week course, then we did another one, and then the funding got cut. And that happened twice in two other schools. And I was just kind of, there's no follow up. There's no, there was no sustainability in it. I was like, what is going to happen now? Like,
yeah, it's just, that's so frustrating. Yeah.
So I was kind of pondering this problem. And I created Loom.
Yay! finally going to talk about
yeah.
it.
No.
You've definitely got over.
Yeah. Yeah, so Loom is a social enterprise. I'd had, whilst I was at school, high school, I'd actually gone to Ghana and Malawi
wow.
for periods of time, working with microcredit finance organizations, okay, yeah. which use... enterprise to help create people to create their own wealth and to work themselves out of poverty. And I just saw how much dignity that gave people, how successful it was. So I've always been a big believer in that. So yeah, creating a social enterprise was something that was really a no-brainer for me. And basically what we do with Loom is we do corporate mindfulness training courses, workshops and classes, and then that subsidizes mindfulness for school teachers. So we go into schools, we teach teachers one, how to look after their own mental well-being, because the rate of burnout with school teachers is astronomically high.
Really?
Oh my, yeah, it's yeah, a huge issue. And then two, we teach them how to introduce it into the classroom, so we're training the teacher.
That's such a good method, because then you're touching like so many yeah. people through teaching the teachers, I suppose. Yeah.
And it's just a more sustainable way of doing things. And there are also really great programs out there for teaching kids. There are some really, really great ones. So they're kind of taking care of that, but no one's really taking care of the teachers yet. So that's what we're trying to do.
I love that. And I think I can tell how passionate you are about all this stuff. And it's so nice to hear about someone who's gone from doing a job that they didn't necessarily, well, I know you enjoyed it a bit, but I can tell that with this stuff you just are so behind this yeah. mission. And how does it feel, I guess, like working towards that mission every single day that you've created versus what you were doing before?
On the whole, it feels great. Yeah. Some days I'm like, why am I doing this? I just want someone to give me a paycheck yeah. and me not to have to like worry about
yeah.
any of this. But no, it's great. Like I just, there is no question in my mind that it's not going to succeed yeah. and that it's not, people need it.
People do, need definitely.
It. People are literally killing themselves yeah. because they don't understand the point of their existence. And I just, if I, again, it's that kind of thing of responsibility. If I have the tools to help people have a little bit more inner peace and help live yeah. little more satisfied lives, then I'm just like, here are the tools.
Yeah. Like, and even when we think back to like our time in sales as well, sales is so pressurizing. It's so on all the time. And you can do like 200% of your target one quarter, but then you're back at zero again. Yeah. And so like all this corporate mindfulness and introducing this into places like sales forces and stuff like that, so, so important, I think.
It's just, I think the responsibility and the relationship between an employer and the employee is changing. People are demanding more from their employers, which I think is great. And employers often provide maybe a gym membership for their employees. Why aren't they training their minds as well to deal with the stresses of the job? And maybe they don't have a responsibility to take care of their employees, but they also definitely have a responsibility not to mess up their employees. And I think that mindfulness training is just proven time and time again to be the most effective way of building mental resilience. So I just don't understand why a company wouldn't provide that.
Yeah, I totally agree. But I think that's amazing, and I love what Loom is doing as well. And I like the kind of hybrid of working with corporates, which is really, really important, but then also being able to help with the schools and taking your experience from that government scheme almost.
Yeah. And I think that also appeals to a lot of companies as well. I think consumers are wanting to make more compassionate choices with how they spend their money. Obviously, it's kind of mindfulness is built into the very core of our operation, how we're doing things. It's a mindful business in and of itself, which also happens to be doing mindfulness. And I think it just really resonates with people that when they're investing in their employees' well-being, they're also investing in the community around them and their mental well-being. Of, because we try and do work with schools within a 1 mile radius of the company.
So it's really linked. That's
so it doesn't always
doesn't
always happen like that, but that's what we really try to do. A lot of companies have links with schools as well already. But yeah, it's like you invest in employees and then you're also investing in your local community.
I think that's amazing. And I also wanted to ask you a little bit, because we met obviously through, we had the same business coach, Lauren, who is coming on the podcast in the future. So watch out for that one. But what was your experience of working with a coach, and why do you think that's so important?
Because first of all, Lauren's amazing. And I just knew that I wouldn't get anything done because I'd get so caught up in my own excuses, my own fears and whatever, unless I literally paid someone a shit ton of money to be like, listen, this is what you're doing, this is what you said you're gonna do, and do it. So it was great, it was great. Accountability, but also just really practical things like accounting software or CRM software, or how to take payments online, just stuff like that. But I was just constantly, I don't know how to do this. But then also just to cut through my own BS, being like, that's an excuse. Or like, you know, you build up all these things in your head, and Lauren has this great way of just being like, but why?
I think you're making that up. Yes, I know, Australian accent. But Susie, why couldn't you do that today?
You're like, ah! So yeah, and I just knew it was an investment. It was, you know, a good coach doesn't come cheap. But I just knew that making that investment meant that I was taking it seriously.
I totally agree, and there's definitely an argument for like return on investment there as well. And I thought about it in that way, like if she, I could, well, I don't know, maybe I couldn't, but it, maybe I could do all these things myself, but it would take 2-3 years for me to do it, whereas if I worked with her, she would be able to speed up that process so much, because I'd like wouldn't make the mistakes that I necessarily would. And then I thought, well, if she can help me build a business to a point in a certain amount of time, that will pay for itself. So
yeah definitely. And even just like the mental health support of like having someone to check in and like validating how kind of, you know, difficult it is, or the ups and downs, or like being like, I get it, like I was there too.
100% Especially coming out of corporate as well, and having so many people around you for that reason, and managers and things, and then being on your own and having nobody, if you don't have a co-founder, it's almost like such a good option to have a coach.
Definitely, I 100% recommend it.
Totally agree. Okay, so we're coming up to time, or maybe we've gone over by quite a while. But I guess I just had the one more question about the wellness industry, but do you have time?
Yeah, okay, perfect.
So we chatted a little bit about how amazing it is that there's this, well, relatively new industry, I suppose, that's always kind of been there, but never been, never had attention drawn to it in the way that it is now. So the wellness industry, and people are now talking about jobs in the wellness industry, businesses in the wellness, it's such a buzzword, but it's so new. Like, how do you, what are your thoughts on this, about like the opportunities in the wellness industry at the moment and how it's evolving?
What are my thoughts on it? I think that it's a really exciting time to be working in the industry you're working in. As you said, it's in the very beginning, I think. So people kind of starting a career in wellness, or transitioning into a career in wellness, there aren't really any like well-trodden paths. And it's also, it can be quite expensive to get the training and things, because there aren't kind of grad schemes and things like that. So I think that that means that it's become quite only a certain background, a certain economic background, can afford to do it. So something I'd love to see is more diversity in the wellness industry, of, you know, racial diversity, gender diversity, and also financial diversity. And that's one of our missions with Loom is to be able to start training teachers up from diverse backgrounds. We are not there yet, but that is definitely one of our missions, is to start bringing more diversity into that sphere. And I also think there's going to be some more clarification around kind of regulation and qualifications that people need to have. And I think that's just, I think that's important to stop people getting ripped off. And also, I think that a lot of people kind of jumped on this hype, maybe on Instagram a few years ago. I feel like Instagram is evolving, but a few years ago it was kind of all these like girls in bikinis doing yoga on the beach, or squatting with their bums like in the camera and stuff, and like in their gym kit and like coffee scrubs and stuff.
Hashtag wellness.
Exactly. And then I think people are getting into it and seeing the reality is actually, oh, you've actually still got to run a business and stuff. So I think kind of the quality and the people who have invested in themselves and the correct training, that will prevail, and then the other stuff will kind of filter out. I feel like it's a similar thing that happened in the tech industry. Like during the, you know, startup tech boom with Facebook and Instagram, like everybody was launching an app or a you know, a website or whatever, and now people are kind of being like, oh, it's not actually an overnight success.
Almost see it similar as well with the fitness thing or diet, I suppose. And like, I feel like there were so many crazy diets of like maybe 5 years ago, or crazy fitness regimes that people were saying that were just a bloody nutrition. That was super extreme. And I almost feel like it's now with diet and fitness, it's like now coming around that actually, no, just back to basics, like calorie deficit and stuff like that, and just like eating healthily and working out. And I almost feel perhaps wellness industry might go that way, like there's so much at the moment and all these crazy different things, and it might consolidate a bit more.
And I honestly, like, I know the people that I now follow on Instagram are highly qualified professionals with experience in putting out really useful, good quality content out there, and that would just be my one piece of advice. And this is something Lauren was really instrumental in. She was like, invest in your training and play the long game. Like, we're so bombarded with messages of kind of overnight successes and things like that, but I would just say play the long game. Like, you want to be doing something of value, you want to be doing something that's well founded and well researched, and like invest in your proper training and like think of it as a lifelong investment, not just over the next couple of years so you can have a banging Instagram account.
I totally agree. And I, sometimes when we do hear these overnight successes, it's just what we've seen. It's like we don't see the 5-10 years that's gone behind it to get that level of publicity. It's so interesting. Right. Let's move on to the quick fire round. You'll be happy we're nearly finished now. Okay, so what's the best book that you've ever read?
Oh my god. Ever.
Yeah.
I mean, I read a lot.
Okay.
A lot.
Or one that springs to mind.
I love Shantaram. I know. The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. Okay. It's also great.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about it.
So those who don't know about Paulo Coelho, he is a Brazilian author who writes kind of allegorical stories, so they have like a meaning in them and there's a message in them, but it's about a guy that basically tries out all these jobs, gets all these riches, this wealth, and then realizes that everything he ever wanted and needs is inside him. It's amazing. It's really, really good.
Okay, sounds good. And also it's
like a fictional one, right? So yeah, most people give me non-fiction answers. So that's very interesting.
Oh, I mean, I
like, no. Yeah. Not in a critic. Like, it's great to have a bit of diversity.
I think fiction, I think, actually hits home harder.
Yeah, I know what you mean. When it's something that's been, completely created. Yeah. Okay, second one. So I created Well and Wild with the sense that to be well in life, you need to do some wild things and dare to go against the norm, basically. So what's the wildest thing that you've ever done?
Oh my God. See, I kind of had quite a wild, like...
Yeah, I feel like working for a king.
Yeah, I was that person that I just like was literally like... Oh, like, you know, I'm going to go and live in Paraguay for 6 months.
What? Did it come up?
Yeah. Or like Buenos Aires. And then the past couple of years about me, my real practice being like learning to stay in one place and not be like, oh my God, how cool would it be to go to like Antarctica? Yeah. Let's go. Oh my God. If I had to pick, I mean, yeah, India was pretty wild.
Yeah.
That was anyone that's ever been to India can testify that it's just like a world unto itself.
Yeah, I went in May actually. Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, so I was there for 6 months and like working for a king, and there were monkeys and it was wild. It was
good,
like
answer.
Bizarre. Working for an Indian king, that would be it.
Yeah, I haven't had that one before. Okay, so finally, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
I think, can I give two?
Yes.
So the first one is something my mum said to me, and it was when I was working in Barcelona and I was not really enjoying who I was working for. And she said, you can work for people you don't like, but you can't work for people you don't respect.
Mm.
And I think we get so caught up in being liked that. And yeah, so I often now I'm kind of like, in the work I do, I want to be respected for it as opposed to necessarily liked. Because work ethic and stuff comes into that. And then I think also that one from Lauren about playing the long game.
Yeah.
Like, I'm definitely, I think, a millennial, stereotypical millennial kind of fault, weakness is instant gratification. And I'm so, so guilty of looking at different people on Instagram and how they've monetized their businesses. And also I'm like, how do I speed things up? And it's like, actually, no, like, slow down, keep showing up, keep doing the work. Play the long game, and it's about a lifetime as opposed to the next 2-3 years.
Yeah, it's like about not giving up, basically.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
I love that. That's amazing. Okay, so where can the listeners find you and Loom, and perhaps I've got a lot of corporate listeners if they're interested in contacting you about mindfulness workshops and things. How can they get in touch?
Definitely. So I am on Instagram. Is at Jessica Leonard Hull, so you can drop me a message there. And then I also have a YouTube channel where I share lots of resources about introducing a mindfulness practice. I have some stuff for mindfulness for kids there, as well as guided practices. So that's Jessica Leonard on YouTube. And then the Loom account is at Loom Global for Instagram. And then www.loom.co.uk is our website. That's Lume.
And I can link all this. There's like show notes that I can link it in as well. So for anybody who wants to go and click on those. But thank you so much for coming. Sorry, I took so much of your time.
Covered a lot of things.
But that was fun. Really good conversation. Thanks, Jess.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening this week. I hope that you enjoyed this episode with Jess. She's such an inspiring lady, and I just think it's so fascinating to hear her insights into the science behind mindfulness and things like that. I hope that you took a lot away from the episode, especially how important it is to go and experiment and upskill yourself when you want to kind of go on a path to entrepreneurship after your corporate life. I hope that you enjoyed the episode. I would be very grateful if you could hit subscribe so that you don't miss any future ones. I've got some great guests lined up. If you want to see my Bali updates, please head over to my Instagram. It's SusieClark_, so SUZIECLARK_. And anyway, I will speak to you next week. Have an amazing week.